Well, before I get to my main topic, I'd like to start on a bit of an optimistic note, the same way I did last week. We've had some really warm weather here. Feels like spring is coming. It's really nice. It's not that warm out here right now. It's 41 degrees, and there's a bit of a wind here in St. Paul, but it's supposed to get to 65 today, so that's pretty nice. And one nice thing about the warm weather is it's probably going to help our construction project at MZMC. If you're new you don't know about the construction project, I'll just tell you that we're adding some handicap accessible bathrooms on the first floor. We're making a new entrance. We're replacing some windows and some stucco, and we're building a new Zendo. And it is all in progress right now. And the timetable right now, they say that the construction project should be done late June, which I think sounds pretty good. And I'm cautiously optimistic. There could be more delays. Those things tend to happen. It may take us a bit after the construction is completed to get things set up for people to come in. But I'm just really hoping that by, you know, midsummer or so, we'll be back in our new space, if the COVID situation allows it. And perhaps it will be limited access and we may be wearing masks. We really don't know, but I'm pretty optimistic. And it's one of the, I would say, most heartwarming things that I've experienced to see how much our Sangha has held together during this difficult time. It's been just about a year now. I think this Saturday will be the 1 year anniversary of when we closed MZMC. And the way the community has held together and even grown a little bit during that time is really wonderful. And I just feel like if we can survive this, we can survive anything. And perhaps the adversity will even make us stronger. So if I may bow to everyone, let's bow together. Let's just bow to our community. So this morning, I'd like to talk about the rise of Mahayana Buddhism. And it's a pretty straightforward teaching. For some of you, there might be quite a lot of review for you more scholarly types, more experienced types, but there should be some new things here. And for some of you who are new to the tangled history of Buddhism, I'm hoping it'll be kind of useful. A lot of times in Sunday talks, we hear about Mahayana Buddhism and we hear about its counterpart, Theravadan Buddhism, and it's not always easy to keep them straight. It took me a long time to really kind of get this. So I've thought for some time about devoting a Sunday talk to this topic, and I find this stuff fascinating. I hope you do too. And I'll talk a little bit about the implications for our practice. So for this talk, I'm heavily indebted to Damien Keen. That's K-E-O-W-N. Of the University of London, who wrote a little book called Buddhism, A Very Short Introduction, I followed his organization and it was very helpful. So let's start by taking a look at the Buddha's death. The story, as it's told by Daisaku Ikeda, is that after the Buddha had been teaching for many, many years, he was invited by a blacksmith named Chunda to take a meal with him. Unfortunately, the meal included some bad mushrooms, and that was the cause of the Buddha's death. He was over 80 at the time. His last act before dying was welcoming an ascetic into the order. And the last thing he said before he died was, "Decay is inherent in all composite things. Work out your own salvation with diligence." And we don't know just when that occurred, or if it occurred that way at all, but some dates that are given are 486 BCE or 410 BCE. But after the Buddha's death, there was a series of councils people got together to kind of clarify, organize the Buddha's teaching. And the first one was held in the year of his death at Rajagraha, and they wanted to establish the canon, that is the Buddha's teachings, which at that time were transmitted only orally, not written down at all. And Mahakashapa, who would become the Buddha's first successor, was the facilitator of this meeting. And Ananda, who had been the Buddha's attendant and would be his second successor, was not invited to the council because he wasn't enlightened yet. In her book, Zen is Eternal Life by G.U. Kenick, she says, it took Ananda almost five times as long as it took anybody else to realize the truth of Zen, simply because of his love of clinging to books and knowledge. So that's one story. I heard a different version from Tim at my ordination. He said the reason that it took Ananda so long to become enlightened was that he was too busy attending to the needs of the Buddha and the needs of the Sangha for all of those years. And I like that last version better, especially since Tim named me after Ananda. But be that as it may, Ananda, on the eve of the council, retired to his hut and decided he was going to become enlightened or bust. Do or die, he's going to become enlightened. And he sat up all night, may have been several days, but at the end, all night, and did the most intense practice he could possibly do, and he still was not enlightened. And he gave up. He gave up. I will never be enlightened in this lifetime. And he lay down to sleep. And the moment his head hit his pillow, that's when it happened. Something shifted in him. The great shift of perspective occurred, and he became enlightened then. After he gave up, after he stopped trying. There may be a little message for us there. So they let him come to the council. And Ananda had the remarkable ability to remember every word the Buddha ever said. So at the council, he recited all of the sutras. And another monk named Upali recited the Vinaya, which were the monastic rules. So the first council happened, and eventually this thing happened called the Great Schism. Sad but true. People tend to divide, even Buddhists. And there were a number of disagreements after the Buddha's death. And the most serious of them happened about a century after his death. And it was between two groups. One was called the elders, and the other was known as the Universal Assembly. And the debate was about maybe different things. There may have been personalities involved. I don't know. It may have been about whether an arhat was inferior to a Buddha in certain respects. It may have been because the elders wanted to introduce additional rules of conduct to the many who already existed. And Buddhism was spreading to new places and encountering new cultures, and there were stresses and strains. But anyway, both of those groups, the elders and the Universal Assembly, split into various subgroups. And of the ones derived from the elders, Theravada is the only one that survived. And of the ones from the Universal Assembly, they all died out, but they left a legacy that evolved into Mahayana Buddhism. So I'd like to talk about the difference between these two great schools, which exist today, Theravada and Mahayana. And as I said, it took me a long time to get this straight. And every time I thought I had a handle on it, some new kind of contradiction would arise or something. So I'm going to try to navigate this by listing a few basic differences. But first, just a little note on nomenclature. Mahayana means great vehicle. And many times in the past, the other great stream has been referred to as Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle. And guess who gave it that name? They did not name themselves the lesser vehicle. They were named the lesser vehicle by the Mahayana Buddhists. And it's really a put down. And sometimes you still see it. People still use it. But it's really, it's not a very good word to use. Much better to say Theravada, which in Pali means way of the elders. And I'd like to say that I do not in any way consider Theravadan Buddhism to be a lesser vehicle. I have enormous respect for it. And I believe it's simply different, appealing to practitioners in a different way. I think there are different traditions because there are different kinds of people. That doesn't mean that some are right and some are wrong. So Mahayana Buddhism developed, began to develop 300 to 500 years after the Buddha's death. And it expanded. It took the northern route through Tibet, China, Korea, Japan, also Vietnam. So Zen Buddhism, which we practice, is Mahayana. And Theravadan Buddhism exists primarily in Southern Asia, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. And in the US, we have Vipassana centers. Those are Theravadan. Common Ground in Minneapolis, which is a wonderful center, is a Theravadan-based center. And Theravadan Buddhism is considered generally to be much closer to the actual practice of the Buddha. And its ideal is the arhat, a spiritual enlightened person whose objective is nirvana, personal liberation from the cycle of being. And Theravadan Buddhism relies on the Pali Canon, which is the collection of the Buddha's teachings that grew out of that first council. And Theravadan Buddhism has a very strong monastic tradition. So I'm going to list five characteristics of Mahayana. First, Mahayana was a reaction to what some monks perceived as being a kind of dogmatism that had crept into the practice. Things had gotten hardened. The life had kind of been eliminated from these teachings, and they were reified. And so Kogen Mizuno says that Buddhism at that time concerned itself first and foremost with strict observance of the monastic precepts and study of the scriptures. And these are things that can get hardened. You know, you got to follow the rules. You got to follow the scriptures. There's a right and a wrong way of doing it. And there was a literal interpretation of the canon. And in contrast, these sort of proto-Mahayana folks wanted to interpret the words of the scriptures in accord with their deeper meaning. So they regarded their more liberal approach as a way of reviving the founders' original intentions. So to what extent their point of view that things had been hardened and become dogmatic, I'm not so sure, but there was certainly that perception. And a great place to see this reaction against dogmatism is in the Heart Sutra, which we chant 5 days a week at MZMC. And it's great to chant it over and over, and you don't really need to know what the words mean. There's still great value in chanting it. And that's probably a topic for another day. But it is also very useful to study the Heart Sutra and learn what it's about. And it's an incredibly rich distillation of Mahayana Buddhism. And basically, it lists all of the doctrines of Buddhism and says they do not exist. For example, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path. That is negating the Four Noble Truths. So this is an effort to take a really deep look and say that nothing exists apart from other things. Nothing has an independent existence. Everything is interconnected, or you could say empty. So we don't put anything really up on the pedestal and say that is apart from and special and different from this world. So even the concepts set forth by the Buddha are empty in a sense. Useful, true in a relative sense, but ultimately empty. Francis Cook says, even emptiness is empty. So no dogmatism, constant renewal, just this moment, less religion, more immediate presence. So the practice implication of this is avoid dogmatism. Nothing is sacred, not even the Buddha's teaching. It's our own responsibility to become enlightened. We can't take that easy route of just finding what the right rules are and following them. We have to find our approach to life deep within ourselves. We do the work. We work out our own salvation with diligence, as the Buddha urged in his last rules. So, second difference, and I've already, you know, started merging into this, is Mahayana's emphasis on emptiness or interrelatedness. Mizuno says that the reformers of the time thought that the Buddhists of the time overemphasized karma and the results of their own actions. So their ideal was nirvana, which they saw as escapist. And the reformers said this was counter to the Buddha's true message, which was that everything is interrelated. And because everything and everybody is interrelated, we need to save one another. And some other, I won't get into this a lot, but some of the early Buddhists talked about dharmas being the building blocks of all phenomena, which were impermanent, but they were also real, that they kind of had a separate reality. Hence the negation in the Heart Sutra. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No this, no that. Whatever you think of, no, not that. So Nagarjuna, in particular, said that dharmas lack any inherent reality. They are empty of any real being. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. It means that they have no independent existence. They exist in relation to other things. Now, the Buddha didn't talk about emptiness per se, but Mahayana Buddhists inferred it from his talks on impermanence and no self. So, emptiness. Another implication of emptiness is that nirvana and samsara are the same. So samsara is this troubled world, this cycle of existence, this realm where suffering exists. And nirvana is liberation from it. But if all things are ultimately empty, then they are all really the same. And you can't elevate one state of being and call it nirvana and say it's better than samsara. If things are different from each other, if they seem different from each other, that's just our perception. It's not about escaping this world and going to a better place. This is the place right here. Yes, there is suffering. There is this world of forms. Yes, there is liberation, but it's all right here, right now. And we can wake up to it and understand, deeply connect with both of those things simultaneously. This is nirvana. This is samsara. So what is the implication for practice here? If we're not looking to leave the world for a better place, well, then our emphasis is on clearly seeing the things of this world, on being awake right now, on immediate experience. And that's the emphasis of Zen especially. It's not about practicing to make something wonderful happen in the future. It's about being here right now. Just this morning, just my cold fingers right now. So the third characteristic is an emphasis on compassion, as opposed to working toward one's personal enlightenment. Again, Theravadan Buddhists are certainly compassionate, but there was this dispute, I think, as to how compassion was to be woven into the basic doctrines. So this emphasis on compassion is consistent with interrelatedness or emptiness. If we're all the same, if we don't exist apart from each other, then we care for one another. So Mizuno says that the Mahayanists claimed that the Buddhists of the time only sought personal deliverance. They said that they had an excessive emphasis on study, which left the monks no time to work for the betterment of society, that the emphasis was really on monastic life and very little on lay life, and the monks were really quite apart from the community. So the reformers thought that to reaffirm the Buddha's original position, they had to find to follow the way of the bodhisattva rather than the way of the arhat. So the bodhisattva is this new construct central to Mahayana Buddhism. Bodhisattva literally means enlightenment being. So a bodhisattva is a being who seeks Buddhahood but renounces complete entry into nirvana until all beings are saved. They stay behind and help everyone in the world. And we don't want to get too technical about this. Keen says that the distinction between an advanced bodhisattva and a Buddha is pretty fuzzy. But there are many bodhisattvas, as many of you know. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of great compassion, known as Kuan Yin in China, Kanon in Japan. There is Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who wields a sword to cut through delusion. Samantabhadra, riding his elephant, which has six tusks, whose characteristics include working for the betterment of all people in kind of an organized way. There is Jizo, the savior of deceased children, the savior of people condemned to hell. He's a bodhisattva portrayed as a monk. So these are inspirational figures that help us to do our practice. And we meet bodhisattvas in our daily lives too. So the practice implications for this compassion piece, how we act in the world, is crucial. And I talk quite a lot about action in the world, because I think that is deeply woven into the fabric of Mahayana Buddhism, and it can't be ignored. So, the fourth characteristic of Mahayana Buddhism is that Mahayana Buddhists see themselves as more, you could call it democratic, as reaching out to a broader range of people. Mahayana, at least in the early stages, was very practical. It emphasized salvation of regular folks, strove to teach them about how to accomplish the sort of the highest way of living without getting too hung up about philosophical problems. And Jack McGuire says in Essential Buddhism that emphasizing compassion was consistent with this more democratic view. For lay people, the compassionate elements of the Buddha's teaching were very accessible, and perhaps for some, more accessible than his emphasis on self-discipline and spiritual refinement. So, and Mahayana Buddhism, in some places, it has been very monastic, monastery oriented. It was in China, but there was a lot of reaching out to lay people as well. In Japan, the temples became the monasteries are training temples, but the temples that people attend are more open to lay people. And here in the United States, this is very much a lay practice, which is wonderful. So the practice implication of this piece about it being more democratic, you could say, is that Buddhism is accessible to all. In the United States especially, there is less of a distinction between lay people and monks. We have priests and lay persons here at MZMC, but we all practice together. We also have lay teachers. And the difference between lay and priestly people is not so pronounced as it is in some other places. So again, the responsibility, the burden, and the joy is on each person to find their own way. We don't leave it to specialists. We're all here to practice. We're not here to hear from the people who practice what it's like. We're here to do it ourselves. And then the fifth characteristic, and this is the last one, is new ideas about the Buddha. And this part is probably the most challenging, so bear with me. Are you all still with me? Okay, all right, still with me. Thank you very much. New ideas about the Buddha. So Keen says, as the Bodhisattva ideal comes into the foreground, the Buddha begins to recede a little bit as a figure and becomes more sublime, a little less of a person and a little more of this sublime figure. He's seen as a semi-devotional figure, and these devotional cults spring up. And this part was really hard for me to understand at first, because this is kind of part of these more, you could say, religious elements coming into Mahayana Buddhism. Not only is the Buddha becoming a more divine figure, but we have bodhisattvas who remind some people of saints in the Catholic Church, and we have gods and goddesses and all of these sort of ritual practices. And this seems strange to me because I think of Mahayana as getting back to the Buddha's core teaching, to kind of getting beyond the trappings of monastic life, getting beyond the trappings of study, and getting to just the basic and immediate stuff. So what's with all this religious stuff coming in and kind of, you know, complicating the picture? Well, to try to answer that, for one thing, these ritual and religious elements, I think, fit with the ideal of being more democratic. As McGuire put it, allowing Shakyamuni and other Buddhas a more intimate, beneficial, and constant relationship to all of humankind. So these devotional elements, like chanting and bowing, make the practice more accessible to all. Not everyone can meditate all day. Some folks are not able to do that. Not everyone wants to be a monk. I may not be able to sit in front of my altar every day for 30 minutes, but I can bow to my altar. I can chant in front of my altar. Just about anyone can do that. So a little more about how this sort of semi-divinity can be consistent with sort of getting back to the basics. The Buddha is now presented as having three bodies. And this is a complex teaching. I can't get into it too much today. But the basis of this teaching is that a Buddha has different aspects. A Buddha is manifests in the physical world to help all beings, but also has this absolute aspect. And I think this is consistent with the teaching on compassion. The Buddha manifests himself in the world to help all beings. But now the emphasis is on the absolute nature of the Buddha rather than the historical Buddha. And the three bodies are Nirmanakaya, the body of transformation. That's the earthly body in which the Buddha appeared. That was the guy. Sambhogakaya is the body of bliss. That's the body of Buddhas who exist in a Buddha paradise and enjoy the truth they embody. And so the bliss body, maybe what some conventional ideas about nirvana might be like, this just pure happiness. And then Dharmakaya, the mind teaching body, the true nature of the Buddha, which is identical with transcendental reality, the nature of the universe. So we've taken the Buddha from being a guy who teaches to being the universe itself. So we're thinking of the Buddha as sort of thusness, that which is. It's the unity of the Buddha with everything existing. And at the same time, it's the Buddha's teaching. It is timeless. It has no characteristics. And it is free of all duality. So in the third of these, Dharmakaya, the Buddha as everything, we can see how this sort of semi-divine nature of the Buddha is consistent with emptiness, which is basic to the Mahayana view. If we see the Buddha as being identical with transcendental reality, as being unity with everything existing, then our emphasis is on emptiness, not so much on the historical Buddha and his teaching. So I'm using this phrase semi-divine because that's what it feels like, but the Buddha is not a god at all in the conventional sense. Buddhist practice is about that which is beyond distinctions. We're not separate from the Buddha. We are the Buddha. So the seemingly religious elements are in a way anti-religious. Although we're putting the Buddha up on the altar, it's not about setting up some entity or God that is above us or separate from us. It's about setting up this being that can help us see that nothing is separate. We're setting up a separate being to help us to see that nothing is separate because we're people and we need to do this because we can't just jump into seeing non-duality. So Zen Buddhism, which is one branch of Mahayana Buddhism, has a really complex attitude, I think, toward ritual practice. We stress the prime importance of waking up. And at times we might say ritual practices are useless. It's just about being awake right now. And yet we have them. And in the end, I think we're really practical. We use what works. And there is the fact that in order to become awake, there is a kind of giving up that happens. You can't sort of discipline yourself into being awake. Ultimately, you give yourself. And other power, religious type practices can help us with that. When I bow deeply to the Buddha, that is a way of reminding myself, it's not about me. So the practice implication for this last one is that devotional practice can help us to awaken. We know that the Buddha is not a god, and yet we can bow down to the Buddha, bow down to the whole universe, which includes ourselves, and say, this is not about me. I devote myself to that which is. That is my route to losing the burden of the self, which sees everything in a selfish way, which is a false view of the universe. So that's my route to happiness. So those are the five things. There's a lot of detail there, but I hope you can kind of see the threads. So the five things are, again, a reaction to dogmatism. People felt that the teachers' teachings had become goals in themselves, had become kind of lifeless. Mahayana seeks to reestablish that the teachings point to something underneath, and it's that something, or we could say that nothing, that's important. So we even go so far as to deny even the Buddha's teachings. And number two, emphasis on emptiness. Nothing, not even the Buddha's teaching, is separate from everything else. Nothing is real in that sense. It only exists in relation to other things. Number three, emphasis on compassion. Compassion is related to emptiness and also interconnectedness. Number four, a kind of democratic view that salvation is something that can come to everyone, not just monks. And then finally, new ideas about the Buddha, the three bodies of Buddha idea, the idea of a kind of eternal Buddha identified with all of interconnected reality that can help us to wake up. So, and when we get to Zen, the no dogmatism part, we're really good at that because Zen is kind of revolutionary. Zen is kind of whatever you say it is, it's not that. You know, like forget everything I've said today, just sweep your floor, don't study, sweep, that kind of thing. So there's a strong emphasis in Zen on daily activity and a strong emphasis on the teacher-student relationship, because you can't learn this stuff from books. It's something you work out with people who have gained some deep insight into it. It can't be found in books, and yet we use books and we use like things like ritual and devotional practices to help us find this subtle, immediate thing. And of course, Zen emphasizes meditation a great deal. That's our big thing. And I encourage you to have a strong meditation practice, a regular meditation practice at the heart of it. If you've been doing this a while, if you've been doing it for years, keep it up. Whether it's great, whether it's hard, whether you're on a plateau, just keep at it. If you're new, challenge yourself a little bit, whether that means 10 minutes a day or that means a half minute a day. I mean, a half minute a day, whatever. Half hour a day, I think is what I meant to say. So that's what I have to say this morning.